Well, the reason I've picked this is I'm not enormously enthusiastic about Capote's early short stories. Actually, the ones that went into making his reputation as a young writer have a kind of dustiness which you feel in John O'Hara short stories, which you feel in a lot of 1955, right up until the 60s. There's a kind of dustiness about the prose. It's really spottable. The exception to that for me is this strange story, and I think it's a prophetic story, but I don't think he knew it was prophetic. I don't think he had any idea that he was writing his own obituary when he wrote it. It's called Shut a Final Door, and I'll discuss why it's like an obituary, but I'll just say that he wrote it in 1947, right after the war, when he was 23 years old. He was just making a name for himself. He'd just published Other Voices, Other Rooms. He had his first check, I think it was for $20,000, and so he was feeling pretty cocky, and he banged off the story. Harper's turned it down, but then another preeminent magazine bought it for $300, and Capote went around with his check for $300 saying, "See, I just sold another short story." And it was Shut a Final Door. But what he didn't realize was that buried inside the story was a vision he had about his own life. And not just his own life in the next year or so, but his entire span of life, right to the end. In other words, what the story is about is what would happen to Capote if he continued to indulge his worst characteristics. And those were not at that stage of the game, booze and pills. That was a problem, but it was a later problem. His problem at this stage of the game was he had a classic gay bitchiness about him, which is that he didn't have a good word for anyone. And he was not above making a clever joke, but a put down in public for almost anyone around. And as you learn later on in your life, going through life with ugly thoughts about people, no matter how beautifully you articulate them, poisons the soul. And I think Capote started to poison his soul by being like the guy is in this story, but I don't think he had any idea. And as his life progressed, he became more and more like the guy in the story that he wrote when he was 23, and finally died exactly like the guy, and whose life came to a difficult and punishing and painful end, because if you shit on people, eventually they all hear about it. Eventually, they all turn on you. It's like they say, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but not all the people all the time. And I think Capote just badmouthed so many people that near the end of his life, nobody had a good word to say about him. And this contains the ironic germ that he wrote at 23. And here's the very, very first paragraph. It's a piece of dialogue. And a woman is chastising this young man, who you can realize is Truman Capote. And the woman says to him right at the top of the story, "Walter, listen to me. If everyone dislikes you, works against you, don't believe that they do so arbitrarily. You create these situations for yourself." And then it goes into the prose, which I'm just going to read a little bit from. Anna had said that, and though his healthier side told him that she intended nothing malicious, if she wasn't a friend, then who was, still he despised her for it. And he went around telling everybody how much he despised Anna. What a bitch she was. "That woman," he said, "don't trust that Anna. This plain-spoken act of hers is nothing but a cover-up for all her repressed hostility." Later on in the same paragraph, she dumps him. And she says this very telling speech to him. "I'm sorry, Walter. I just can't afford you any longer. I understand you very well, and I have a certain amount of sympathy. But it's very compulsive, your malice. And you aren't too much to blame. But I don't ever want to see you again. Because I'm not so well myself that I can actually afford it." So that's how the story begins. And that was very much Truman's life at 23, which was he was kind of a prodigy. He published his first story, Miriam, I think when he was 20 years old or 21, in Harper's, and it caused quite a fury. people said, who is this unheard of voice, this Truman Capote from Monroeville, Alabama, who's written a story of breathtaking maturity that at the same time captures something really evil, a primordial sense of evil. This little girl, it's about this little girl who keeps dropping in on this older woman, and she becomes more and more subtly diabolical as the story progresses. Mm. And so one of the things that was so interesting was that how Capote could come into contact with such a pure sense of evil. It had all that southern gothic swamp malice to it, but it's so clearly portrayed. What it is, it's the announcement of a talent. And when you read Miriam, you realize that you are witnessing the birth of an extraordinary talent and somebody who has an extraordinary capacity to explore the domains of evil. So when he wrote, just a few years later, Shut a Final Door. Shut a Final Door is, on one level, it's about a man who just badmouths everyone around. Little by little, he goes through, as people do, he goes through all the people he knows. But there's something more to it than that. It's a story of spiritual warfare, that he is assassinating himself and that he is participating in a kind of evil world. And as he participates in it more and more, his soul starts to rot. And Capote uses some very, very clever imagery. For example, right at the very top of the story, he situates it in New Orleans. And he talks about the extraordinary heat. Mm. He says it was August, but it was as though bonfires burned in the red night sky, in the unnatural southern landscape, observed so assiduously from the train, which, trying to sublimate all else, he retraced in his memory, intensified a feeling of having traveled to the end, the falling off. And so the story is also about a guy's descent into a self-created hell. Mm. And it becomes, as his social circle gets smaller and smaller, and as a girlfriend of mine once told me, she said, you know, David, if you start talking about what's wrong with your friends, you're going to find yourself friendless eventually. And what happens in the story is that it's his first victim is this harmless little guy who befriends him.
The end of the second paragraph, he says, what was the use of having friends if you couldn't discuss them objectively?
Yeah.
So that's his view.
I mean, people who are like that always find a way to rationalize what their behavior is. They're saying, no, I'm not being shitty and backstabbing my friend. I'm actually talking about a friend, and why should you not be able to talk about somebody objectively? In other mm-hmm. words, he's pretending that the recitation of all the things that are wrong with his friend are in fact just the result of an objective analysis of the friend.
That's right.
But it's this game of cat and mouse that he plays with himself all the way through, which is, and I'm sure you've met people like this in your life, they meet new people, and suddenly the new person turns out to be, quote, an asshole. Mm-hmm. And they have a good reason why this person turned out to be a disappointment and an asshole. And they go on and they meet a new friend and they like their new friend. And then the next thing you hear is that guy, well, he turned out to be an asshole too. Well, that's the story with
everyone's an asshole.
He likes people at first and they really like him, but then he finds something wrong with them. And also in his case, some reason to betray them, either to take somebody's job. There's a job under discussion here where he's working for an advertising agency and he covets somebody's position and gets it. In this particular case, he takes poor Irving's girlfriend away. And then I think he dumps her as well.
Well, let's back up to New Orleans for a second.
Yeah.
It seems to me he's using New Orleans a little bit like Thomas Mann used Venice, a kind of a debauched Babylon.
On a simpler level, too, of course, it's in the deep southern part of the United States, mm-hmm. so it's really hot. And this is a story about a man going to hell. Going to New Orleans is just the metaphor for, in fact, a descent into hell. And there's this image which keeps coming up, which is the he's in a hotel room in New Orleans, and he has these blades and the fan that kind of whirling around and around.
Well, he also gets a couple phone calls from the devil, doesn't he?
Well, I wondered about that, just to set it up for the listeners.
Yeah.
As he goes through this process of alienating and ripping off one person after another and putting down one friend, and but they're small betrayals, but they're betrayals. Mm-hmm. They're professional, emotional, and sexual betrayals. And periodically during this story, the phone rings. And he picks up the phone and says, "Who is this?" And a voice at the other line says, "You know who this is. You've always known who this is." And then the narrator, Walter, says, "No, I don't. Who is this?" And the person hangs up. And I've always been intrigued. I've taught this before, and I've asked my students who they think is calling. And it's interesting. Who do you think it is? Do you think it's the devil?
I do, yeah. I think it's either that or his own subconscious knowing that what he's doing is evil.
That's what I think too. I think that phone call is a phone call from his
subconscious.
You know, when you're living badly, when you're living in bad faith, I mean you or me, I have a conscience, and
that's
my conscience speaks to me, and I know when I'm doing something bad. I can feel it in my body.
Although, also, as you say, he continually tries to justify his behavior. Look at this one here. This is just the second page. He says, "And I, the earth, the rings of a tree, everything is a circle, and all circles," Walter said, "have a center." It was crazy for Anna to say what had happened was his own doing. If there was anything wrong with him really, then it had been made so by circumstances beyond his control.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right, because I have a relative, a close relative of mine, unfortunately, who will insist that if you finally get him to admit that he has done the wrong thing, he will say, "Well, what do you expect with an upbringing like the one I've had? Mm-hmm. What do you expect if you've been treated the way I was treated?" In other words, they always have a legitimization for their behavior, an excuse. In this case, you know, he takes Irving's girlfriend, and then he's Margaret, and he sleeps with her for a bunch of times, and then he's unfaithful to her, and then he gets a job at her advertising agent and backstabs her there.
And just kisses up to the boss.
Yeah.
Here's the line, "But he did not know where to begin thinking about himself."
Yeah, that's right.
"Did not know where to find the center."
That's
right. So maybe that phone call is the center calling.
Is the center. And of course, right to the end of the story, he still doesn't know who's making the call. There's no epiphany for this guy. One of the admirable things about, I think, the short story, which is that Capote resists an epiphany. He resists the opportunity to say that this guy understands finally that he's a bad person and he's going to be a different person. The guy is rotten from the beginning of the story right to the last thing. And when he gets that last phone call from the devil or from his conscience, he's still saying, "Who is this?
Yeah.
Who's calling?"
Yeah.
And at one point, Margaret says to him, after they've destroyed this Irving and he attacks him, remember that sad thing? He comes into the bar and he pokes, he hits him in the chest like a girl. And then he says, "Stay away from me. I hate you." And Margaret says, "He'll never be sweet again," she says.
Yes.
And then
we've taught him
Walter
how to hate, right?
Reveals himself and says, "I don't know what you mean."
Like, yeah,
he has no idea of the
consequences. He's a bit like a psychopath. He doesn't know.
That's exactly right. He's either a psychopath or a sociopath, which is to say that he has no sense whatsoever of, if this is the correct definition of a psychopath, is that they have no sense of other people's experience.
Mm-hmm.
They're incapable of feeling other people's pain. And they also have the go-to, which is, well, if it happens to them, they must have had it coming. So the needle never stops there. And that essentially, when you go through the world like a guy like Walter does, when he says, "Shut a final door," it's interesting. You think, what does that title mean? I think it means eventually you run out of people. you burn people and you burn people and you burn people, and eventually you end up all by yourself in a sweaty hotel room with the fan spinning above your head and no one to talk to except the devil. Every single person that he connects with in his story is of some transactional use to him. In other words, people are there to be used, and when their usefulness is used up, you move on.
Used and put down.
Used and put down.
Let's just, if I can just get this on the record here.
Yeah.
What I would prefer us to do is to work slowly through the text.
Through the text.
Together.
Yeah.
So we're on page 119 right now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to bring attention to the beautiful little descriptive he uses of Margaret. What he liked about her was that she had a hectic brightness.
Yes.
That's good.
Yeah, I have a note here beside this which says, what's wrong with Walter? Because his description of his friend is that she's only so-so looking, her eyes bulged, there was always a little lipstick on her teeth, and she dressed like a child of 10. There are people like that, and what they do is they see people as the sum of their worst qualities, of their flaws. Their teeth are wrong, or they smell funny, or they're not very good looking. They always see it in terms of negatives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what almost the very first thing he does is he looks at her, makes friends with her, and then realizes that, well, actually, her eyes bulge, and she's not that good looking.
The other thing, too, that I thought was interesting was that when he starts moving in on Margaret, who is Irving's girlfriend, right?
Right.
It's a weird sort of way that he talks about making love to her. Walter asked if he might not make love to her, she said. All right. She didn't mind if he did. It's kind of a weird sort of backing into it. What's the main motive here?
Well, I have to go outside the text for that line. And that line has struck me a number of times because it's so awkwardly phrased. Will you read it out again when he asks, sir?
So one day when Walter asked if he might not make love to her, she said, all right, she didn't mind if he did.
You see, that is not, for me, a conversation that goes on between heterosexuals. I think what Truman Capote reveals in that is that he's never been with a woman. He's never asked a woman to go to bed with him. And he thinks that this is how it's done in the heterosexual world. And it's really not. And for me, that line really underscores how sexually undernourished
Truman was. We need to turn that fucking thing off.
We'll just pick it up where we...
Yeah.
All right, so I'll pick it up there.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you notice when he brings up the subject of going to bed with Margaret is he phrases it in a very strange way. And first of all, you think it's an artistic choice. But actually, I don't think it was. I know that we're supposed to resist always reading autobiographical impulses into these stories. But I think that that's Truman essentially betraying that he has no idea what sex with a woman is like. He has no idea how you approach the subject or ask someone. It's a gay man's imagination of how us heterosexuals do it. The line, I have to tell you, clunk for me. I thought this is both self-revelatory and bad art. I thought it was bad art.
I think that there's no urgency in this. It's like, oh, I may as well have sex with her.
Right.
It's not like, oh, I can't hold myself back. I desire you so much.
But isn't that like a gay man's attitude towards heterosex?
It's either that or some guy that's not that interested in her particularly.
Right. So you think he wants to do this because this is one of the things you do with a woman in order to get her?
It may be, but there's no real desire.
No, there's no heat.
It's like a negative. It's backing into it.
And that's what I meant, which is that it sounds like you're suggesting almost like it's a pragmatic.
Yeah, a ploy almost. Yeah.
It's like, all right, let's see now. I need Margaret for X, Y, and Z reasons. So what do I have to do? What do you do with a girl? Well, one of the things you have to do is you have to make her like you. And the other thing you have to do is you have to sleep with her. But there's no sexual heat in that. It's a purely... Once again, it's transactional. It's this is what you do to get what you want from
someone else.
Person.
Yeah. Even if it means hurting them.
Yeah.
I don't even think he cares so much about her.
Yeah.
And usually when you want to make love to someone, you care about them.
Yeah. You know, every so often she has to kind of straighten him out. And a few paragraphs later, she's talking about his endless politicking and his endless kind of manipulation of people. And she gives him this flat-handed, it should knock his teeth out, but it doesn't. And she says, take my word, Walter. There aren't any shortcuts. What matters is how you do your job. In other words, there are things in life that you can't go under, around, that you can't manipulate. You just have to, you have a job, you have to do your job well, period. Mm-hmm. It's not a personality contest. And very quickly thereafter, he stands her up, right?
Well, we get into, on page 120, we get into the scene where there is the confrontation and that Irving discovers that they're cheating on him.
And his response is like a child. He says, you go away. I hate you. And then he swings out, and then he strikes Walter in the chest. But like, that's not how a man strikes another one. It was not much of a blow. And when Walter did nothing but smile, Irving slumped against the jukebox, screaming, fight me, you damn coward. Come on, I'll kill you. I swear before God I will. That also, I mean, I don't mean to be going off on a tangent here, but that didn't strike me as a heterosexual's remark either. Yeah. That seemed to me like a young, effeminate man responding to a provocation. In other words, this story is, you know, and I didn't really think about this, this story is gayer than I thought it was.
Well, in fact, there's a line there somewhere where, and let's see where it is, where I thought, wait a minute, the two of them are not in love, but attracted to each other. Where the hell is that? Anyway, it was a point that, yeah, it alerted me to that, the fact that there was more to their friendship, Irving and Walter, than just being buddies.
Yeah, but once again, it's he arrives at this conclusion at the bottom of page 121, and he arrives at this conclusion with everybody, which was one of these days he was going to have to get rid of her, and soon. So he makes these conquests of people, uses them, gets all he can get from them, and then moves on. And remember, shortly after that, he's talking about her boss, and he comes to this conclusion that it was an essay that he wrote when he was in high school. And there's this very telling line in it, and it's sort of the leitmotif for his character's passage through life, which goes, all our acts are acts of fear.
Yes.
And that's around 123. And so it's snuck in through the side door. It's actually strangely true. He's, for one moment, he's true about himself. And he says this, that all our acts are acts of fear. And you know, when I read that, I thought to myself, I mean, is that true? Is that true for me? No, actually, I don't think it is true for me, but I think it is true for him, because if you create your identity by how people look at you, which is what Walter does, then you're constantly frightened that the mask is going to slip, that they'll be onto me.
But he is paranoid. There's no question.
And if I had a head full of snakes like that, I'd be paranoid too, because you're always afraid that somebody is going to see it. But there's a beautiful description here, is that he's in a constant state of envy and jealousy and competitiveness. Capote uses this original line. I've never heard anyone use it before. But he talks about this one guy, this hearty Yale Princeton undergraduate.
Where's that?
It's on page 124. And just being around these guys, these winners, these guys that go right to the top of the class, that get the prettiest girls, that don't have to manipulate, and just being around them, Capote says, made green birds fly in his stomach.
Yeah.
That isn't a beautiful description of somebody feeling sick with envy
and
jealousy.
That, you know, that put me in mind of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's little yellow butterflies. Flying around his head.
I don't know him well enough. Tell me about
that. I'm trying to remember if it was love. It could have been love. there were sequences in A Hundred Years of Solitude where when those butterflies appeared, you knew that the love was in the air.
Oh, yes.
It was lovely.
Yeah.
But yeah. let's just finish page 123, okay?
Okay, because I want to move to 124 because it has one of the best lines on it that, you know, every so often in this story. I mean, I confess that I identified a little bit with it because early in my life, I think I felt some of the things that Walter feels, the kind of jealousy that people around you are doing better than you are, that people see through you and that you're not as interesting as you hoped that they saw.
Well, here he says it was degrading his working for Margaret.
Yes, right.
Okay, that's 121.
Better than your company. And he says right here, he says, and I've done this too, which is what you do to make yourself feel better about yourself is you accumulate friends who make you look good. In other words, the guy who doesn't feel sure about himself thinks, if I get a pretty girl as a girlfriend, people will think that I'm the kind of guy who deserves to get a pretty girl.
Yeah.
And there's this exquisite description he says right here. One evening he went with Anna Stimson to see a film featuring that Randolph girl. The Randolph girl is someone he's just met. And here's what he does. He uses her friendship immediately, even in the presence of strangers. And he says, and before they were scarcely seated, everyone for aisles around knew that she was a friend of his, knew that she drank too much, was immoral, and not nearly as pretty as Hollywood made her out to be. In other words, you gain public recognition by the people who like you. And what you do with the people to show that you're close to them is you betray secrets about them. And that makes people even more convinced that you're close to them, that you're
That's right, because they would only tell that to someone.
Yeah, precisely.
But it's interesting what she says. This is Anna. Now, what's happened is that he's become interested in this other girl. So Anna says to him, this is on page 124 as well, told him he was an adolescent female. You're a man only in one respect, sweetie.
Once again, that's an interesting line about, is that how Truman Capote saw women? Or is that how this, I mean, that's quite a thing for a woman to say about other women.
She said that about Walter.
Right, that's what I mean. But don't you think it's a strange thing for a woman to say about a man, which is, in other words,
definitely,
it implies that that's what all females are like. That was the only thing that struck me as strange. It made me think that maybe Anna was not so healthy because she said, you're an adolescent female. In other words, that kind of behavior is the sort of thing we expect from an adolescent female. I'm not sure a woman would talk about members of her own sex that way.
Well, it's kind of maybe what young girls do. They gossip in an unkind way to put down their...
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly... That is exactly what young girls do. So you're right. It's not actually a particularly kind... And he does say an adolescent female. And adolescent females are, of course, notorious for gossiping in the hallways. You know, but once again, it's, you know, Walter is justifying his behavior this time to dumping and putting Anna down.
And he's also, right at the end of 124.
All his life, some cheat had been dealing him the wrong cards.
That's right, yeah. So again, he's persecuted.
What a sensation. You know, he goes through the world with a pair of threes and thinks, this is what I've been dealt. Those Princeton pricks, those Harvard pricks, they got dealt aces and kings, and I got a pair of threes.
Chip on his shoulder.
And that's one of my favorite lines. All his life, some cheat had been dealing him the wrong cards.
Yeah.
Once again, he's never responsible that when it doesn't work out, it's always because they're cheating. They're cheating me again.
Yeah, that's his worldview.
And you know, I'm not getting my due because I'm being cheated.
Glass half empty.
Yeah.
Now, halfway down 125. And,
well, that's got my favorite line in the whole story in it. So do you want to tell what it is?
Well, we'll see. And I jumped in the cab and slammed the door and leaned out of the window and laughed out loud. who is this Anna again talking about him?
No, this is Truman. This is Walter talking about this really nasty stunt that he pulled on a gay man.
Yeah.
He comes
out. Oh, that's right. He was chasing after him. That's right.
And he flirts with him.
Yeah.
And the man comes dashing out of the bar to follow him. And Truman gets in a, Walter gets in a cab and then winds the window down and laughs in his face because it's so funny to have seen this guy essentially lay down his dignity and be caught pursuing a pretty young guy who's doing nothing but fucking around with him.
Okay. The thing that's striking here is he said, the look on his face, it was awful, like Christ. What's that mean?
Yeah, it was like, I think it emphasizes what follows, which is that it's a joyful sensation. He's talking that he said, when he says the look was awful, that's actually a pleasurable sense. It was like Christ. Oh, it was, oh, you know what? I misread
that. It was like
that.
Christ.
I thought that there was a comment to that. And he said, like Christ, I can't forget it. But it's like Christ, which, of course, he's talking about that he's crucified this guy.
It's the look on his face.
Right.
It was awful.
It was like Christ.
The look on his face was like Christ.
Like a guy being crucified.
Pain. Yeah. Agony.
Like a man being crucified. And then there's this one thing which is lovely, and it's Capote is a very, very, very gifted storyteller because he doesn't load the deck. In other words, it's easy when you're writing a story like this to pile on to a character, to just load on one bad quality after another after another.
Yeah.
And it grows a little monotonous. But there's this line here that doesn't make you forgive Walter, but makes you feel a degree of compassion. And it's at the bottom of 120, middle of 125, and he says, nevertheless, he was conscious of being unloved. And this knowledge was like an extra heart beating inside him.
Right, I've got that underlined.
Yeah, that's a beautiful line.
Sure is.
And also
sure
the sensation,
is.
I mean, who can feel superior or even good about somebody getting their druthers if actually they feel as they go through their day that people don't love them? That's a heartbreaking thing for someone to feel.
And what's so beautiful about this is he feels it all the time because his heart is beating all the time.
Yeah.
And I wonder, can't get rid of that.
Yeah. And do you think it's true, though? I mean, one of the things that makes this guy so despicable is he seems like he is loved, at least initially, by a lot of people. People seem to like him a lot right off the bat until he fucks them.
Yeah.
And so
he goes through
this world feeling unloved, but actually he's not really unloved. It's just that he feels unloved. And then I would just go forward and say that when you feel unloved, it's not long before you behave like someone who's unloved. You start doing the things that someone who's unloved would do.
He's making himself unlovable.
He gets people and he thinks he's getting use out of them, but in fact,
he's hurting them for one thing.
He's hurting them and he's losing them.
Yeah. And so no wonder he's not being loved by them.
So we come up to we're reading along here and we come up to the very first time the phone rings.
Okay, can I just...
do you want to do that?
I want to do... the way we're doing this is we're talking about what we each find interesting in this story, okay?
Yes.
And so we'll do it, you know, together.
Yep.
So at the beginning of the number four, or fourth section of the story, it's on page 126. It starts with, listen, the fan, turning wheels of whisper. He said, you said, they said, we said, round and round, fast and slow, while time recalled itself in endless chatter. Only broken fan breaking silence. August the 3rd, the 3rd, the 3rd. It's like gossip is what's going on. He's talking about all of this gossip. But that's poetic, isn't it?
Oh, it's better writing than it needs to be. I mean, it really is extraordinary. Now, I'm not jumping around here. I'm actually going from one section of things that interest me to the next.
Good.
And
okay.
I'm not...
But you have to wait for me then.
Yeah. So I'll wait for you. So you've got to jump in because I don't know... I'm not... When I've finished making my point, I don't know whether I should wait for you...
Yeah, wait for me to make my point so we're at the same speed here.
Yeah.
We should have had a discussion about this
when we started.
But anyway.
But that, now I know what to wait for. Yeah. So I will wait. So it's like ping pong.
It's like... We're going through the text together at the same speed.
Got it.
So
I'm sorry. You know what? I should have straightened that out with you at the very beginning.
It's my fault.
We were doing it general.
It's my fault.
All right. So we're on page 126, and you've just pointed that out, which is, I mean, that business about, oh, God, he said, you said, they said, we said, around and around, fast and slow. I mean, that is so great. I mean,
it's gossip.
It's gossip, and anyone who's been a victim of gossip or who's been a gossip themselves, I mean, has had that conversation in their head. You lie there because, I mean, the revenge of life on a liar is that you think everyone is lying to you, but also the revenge of life on a gossip is you assume that everybody's gossiping about you, too.
Yeah.
Life can be very cruel, and this is Capote's extraordinary way of saying it. You said, they said, we said, around and around and around. It's like just a nauseating cycle. And I, once again, am on page 127, if I might move there. I recognized an autobiographical note here, but I also had a dear, dear friend from Upper Canada and who was of, I hate to say this, but he was of poor character. I dearly loved him, but he was a poor character, and you would continually forgive him. And I never came across anybody who described my ex-friend so perfectly as this sentence does. The narrator describes Walter this way. And listen to this. He had always been willing to confess his faults, for by admitting them, it was as if he made them no longer exist. You know that standing, somebody confesses their bad deeds to you, and then they think that that means that they've never done them, that they're exonerated from them and they can move on to sin again another day. It's sort of like the Catholic confession, really. You go in, you say your sins.
Yes, that's right. And you're okay to go now.
And you're okay to go.
Well, here's the line that I underlined right in the middle of that page, 127. He went back upstairs and sat at his desk and felt as though he were bleeding inside and wished very much to believe in God.
Oh.
So he's hollow. It seems to me he could be close to suicide there because he doesn't believe in him. There's nothing. It's emptiness.
And then he wishes he had something, just something he could believe in. Because obviously, it comes back to what we were talking about. If you are a liar, you assume that everyone else in the world is a liar. And if you don't believe in yourself, if you know you're a rat and a liar and a louse and a betrayer, you assume everyone else is. And so, by your own definition of the world, there is no one to believe in. There is no one to trust.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're all like you. They're all assholes. They're all cheats.
So what an awful, as you say, it's hell.
Yeah, you are living in a self-created hell because wherever you look, you see a reflection of your own shortcomings. Yeah. And all of this under the excoriating New Orleans sun in this sweaty, shitty little hotel room.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that's the end of the line.
Tawdry.
Yeah, tawdry. It's small time. You know, it's not the devil with the tail and pitchforks and the screen of fire. It is a different kind of hell. It's a shitty, tawdry, small-time hell.
Yeah.
Your turn.
Okay, I'm just halfway down. For the end of the first paragraph on 128, I love you, he said, running after her. This is Margaret again.
Yeah.
I love you, he said, running after her. I love you, he said, saying nothing. So he doesn't believe what he's saying. It's bullshit.
Once again, it's transactional.
Yeah.
It's what you say to get what you... It's almost like I've heard people say that before.
Mm-hmm. Just and they don't tell you I love you just to get laid.
Yeah, they it's the last strategy they can come up with.
Mm-hmm. And it's empty.
They don't mean it. They don't love you. It's just simply the last strategy. And there's something that I was just thinking of. It'll come to me.
Well, in the meantime, she turned around. The blue hair ribbon matched her eyes. And her eyes, gazing up at him, softened, but became rather friendly or pitying.
Oh, yeah. And he tries that pathetic thing about, do you remember the good times that we used to have together? And he says, you know, we used to like to go to Benny's, remember? It's so pathetic. It's like trying to summon up an image when they liked each other before the water was polluted. And she just says, look, I got a date. Goodbye. And I think shortly thereafter, if I'm not mistaken, I keep having those notes all the way through here, which is, once again, Capote is foreshadowing what will happen to him in his own life, which is that he will fuck people around and fuck people around, and then when they finally give up on him and they walk away, he tries the last gambit, which is to say, I love you. Mm-hmm. And I watched a movie once many, many years ago, but there was a line in it about that I've never forgotten. And the man says to the woman, the relationship is on the rocks, the man says to the woman, I love you. And the woman says back to him, she says, whenever you say you love me, it always sounds like you're asking for something. Isn't that beautiful?
That's good, yeah.
And that's exactly what's going on here. He says, I love
you. Well, asking to be told you love them back.
That's right.
Well, and this works into this exactly, the reassurance you said. This is the bottom of page 128. It was like the time he failed algebra and felt so relieved, so free. Failure was definite, a certainty, and there is always peace in certainties. He lives with uncertainty.
I know. That's
he doesn't know if he's loved or what. It's uncertainty is a key part of this story.
I know, and it's also, I mean, you've got to remember that, I mean, I don't know if you remember being 22 or 23 years old when Capote wrote this story, but that is a very sophisticated observation to make about life and the world. And when you consider that Truman Capote was 23 years old, when he wrote that line, which was, failure was definite, a certainty, and there is always peace in certainty. I think that's a very profound observation, and not one that I could have made till I was in my 40s or 50s, and I had enough failures to actually think, you know, sometimes actually the sensation I felt was not bitter disappointment, but was relief. And it took me many, many years to understand. Because, of course, when you fail at something, it's also over. The door is locked. Mm-hmm. The key is thrown away.
You're not in the fight anymore.
You're not in the fight anymore. You're free of the fight.
Well, the other thing, too, this perhaps talks to the fact that he yearns for failure. He's yearning for failure because it gives him peace. So maybe he's sabotaging all of these relationships because he wants to fail at them, because he figures that's the only way he can have peace. I know that's a bit twisted up, but
I think that's I'm not sure that he is that complicated. I think he's more acquisitive than that. In other words, I think you're right that the failure gives him a sense of peace, but I don't think he has the self-awareness, even on a subconscious level, to pursue failure with that as an end.
Okay.
And then we move on here, and this is the first or the second call from the devil.
And where's that? What
and
page?
This is on 129.
Okay.
And he says, who is this? And there's this very telling line. And this is very hard, artistically very hard to pull off, because this could be very melodramatic and very corny. But it works, because it's very sparse. There's very little of it. And it doesn't go on too much. But he says, who is this? And the voice says, oh, Walter, you know me. you've known me a long time. In other words, since the formation of your personality, or rather the formation of your conscience, you have known me because I was born with your conscience. I am your conscience. So you have known me for a long time.
Yeah, then he ends that with a click and nothing. Yeah, I'm good all the way up until the top of 131, and the bar, very large, very hot, and noisy, was brilliant with summer season grotesques.
Oh, yeah, now there's one.
Sagging silver fox ladies.
Yeah, you know, it
is. And a little stunted jockeys.
You know, that's it's good. An overused image, but it's like the bar in Star Wars, you know. It's,
yes.
But also, when you're unhappy, the world does seem to be full of grotesque people. I have noticed, for example, when I've had a breakup with a woman and I've been really devastated and I've wandered around the city in a state of horror, I've been shocked by how horrible the people around me are, how ugly and animalistic they seem, their features seem that. And I realize now that it's actually a projection of how I'm feeling onto the world. But I keep thinking at the time, why, when I'm in this terrible emotional state, would all the ugly people in the world decide to show up today?
That's right. Well, it's like when you're in love, it's the opposite. Yeah. Everyone's gorgeous and beautiful. And,
you think, absolutely.
Yeah. There are sort of little resonating lines or images here. When one of the grotesques is a woman that he doesn't sit down with who has a club foot, because there's a club foot in Madame Bovary. So that's what flashed into my mind. Remember, they do operations on
husband,
it, and it doesn't. And it
her
doesn't.
Husband blows a very rudimentary operation. Yeah. And with the result that the man has to have his leg amputated.
Yeah, a young boy.
But it's a club, it's a relatively small piece of surgery.
Yeah.
And he, Charles Bovary, messes it up and they have to take the kid's leg off. Yeah. Good writers don't use imagery and metaphors deliberately. Bad writers do. So when a good writer does something like something symbolic, it's artistic or it's unintentional, but it's never deliberate. And this clubfoot is very interesting because I think it's subconscious. And what it is here is a man, Walter, who is flawed, but it's all internal. He appears to be an okay person, but actually the rot is internal. Here is a woman he encounters who wears her deformity on the outside. And somehow they are, in a way, a match for each other. They're both flawed. And that also speaks to the same thing, which is, why is it when you're heartbroken that not only do you run into all the ugly people in the world, but you run into somebody with a club foot? And I remember when I read it to myself, I would think, if I were Walter, why, when I'm in this state of enormous fragility, would destiny send me a woman with a club foot? I mean, I'm already half crazy. This is going to push me right over the top. Why today?
There's a mom novel, too, where down toward the bottom of 131, it was depressing to listen to, but Walter, afraid suddenly to be alone, stayed and drank and talked in the way he'd once talked to Anna Stimson.
Yeah, that's very sad. And then, once again, when you're feeling fragile, it does appear the world presents all its grotesqueries. And then he hears this child's voice going, why? Why?
Next door, that's right. Because they go up to the room together.
Yeah, there's no reason for it to happen, but it's like, it's one of those days when all those ugly moments happen to you. And of course, this, I think, emphasizes Walter's descent into hell. That gradually the creatures around him, like Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
More and more grotesque.
Yeah. And it's right at the very end of that section there, section 5. Experience is a circle of which no moment can be isolated, forgotten.
Oh. Isn't that great?
Circle of hell.
Right, right. I hadn't thought of that, but absolutely. That no moment can be forgotten, that it's a continuum. And that's the thing with Dante's Inferno, is that these people are in these macabre situations, but they're in them for an eternity.
Yeah.
Since we're on the last page here, I'm just looking at the notes I made when I read it.
We got a couple more pages to go.
Do we? Oh, where are we here?
We're on 132.
Oh, we're on 132.
Starting section number 6, and the first line that I'm taken with is, She came out of the bathroom wearing only a sleazy, flesh-colored kimono.
And once again, it's just like things are getting uglier and uglier and uglier. Once again, of all the women that he's taken into hotel rooms and into his apartment, why would he end up with this woman with this grotesque club foot and sleazy gown?
Sleazy gown, and then he says, and the monstrous black shoe. And then I've got a little question mark beside, he turned to the window where pressing elm leaves rustled in the rain and lightning too far off for sound winked whitely. And I'm just trying to figure, do I like that or not?
Yeah.
I don't know if I don't think I like it.
That's a good question.
Winked whitely.
I think it's a little bit written.
Yeah.
And I would say in Truman's defense...
He's 23.
That he's 23.
Yeah.
And that's a mistake he would never have made at 33. And he also had an editor who was probably so blown away that a 23-year-old could write like this that he was probably dizzy by the time he arrived at the end of the story. Because you're quite right. That is an example of what Elmore Leonard once said, which is, if it sounds like writing... cut it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then our conscience or the devil calls again.
Yeah. Which is concomitant with his realization that there's this eternity of blades whirling over his head and his realization that this is going to repeat itself like a circle. It's going to go on and on and on. There is, in other words, it's not going to end. It's not going to end with a good night's sleep. It's not going to end getting out of the hotel. It is like Dante's Inferno. It just goes around and around and around and around.
And his response to that, though, is Walter fell across her, clutching her to him, pressing his wet cheek against hers. Hold me, he said, discovering he could still cry.
Yeah, and, you know, and once again, it's still about Walter. It's like the I love you earlier. It's give me, give me, give me, make me feel better. There's no sensation whatsoever of compassion toward the girl, towards this. I mean, the description, the monstrous foot. I mean, that, you know, that's not an especially generous description of a handicapped woman.
It's interesting, isn't it, how he hears his conscience and it makes him break down and cry.
For now. But that's the thing. That's the cyclical nature of this. Mm. And that's very much like that earlier line, which he says, if you admit to having these faults, it's like you're exonerated from having them. Mm-hmm. You get to start all over again, like a good Catholic after confession. I've known people like that who say, well, you know, David, I'm really this kind of person. And you can see the pleasure that they have in the confession because they honestly believe that it exonerates them from the responsibility of the things they're confessing. You know, I cheat on my best friend. I feel really bad. I went to bed with my best friend's sister the other day or my best friend's wife. You can tell by the way that they tell you that the act of confessing kind of neutralizes it for them. And that's why they're confessing to it. Does that make sense to you? Because I've been a bit guilty of that myself in this life, which is confessing to sins and crimes just to clean the tab, sort of saying, well, I can't be that bad because I've admitted that I've done all this stuff, so I really got to be at heart okay.
No, I've never. That's a very, it's a Catholic. I mean, I can imagine A lot of Catholics can feel that. I can't.
Right.
I think what's interesting here, too, is, you know, you're talking about eternity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this cycle of... He must be exhausted because he's not getting what he wants, which is what? It's love, I guess?
It's stillness.
Yes, but he wants peace?
Yeah, he wants stillness.
From what, though?
Just to be enough for life to not be painful. To just be enough, to sit here and not hurt.
Why is it hurtful? Why is
because he doesn't have the things he thinks he wants.
Which are?
Love, fame, money, a lot of meretricious ends, none of which have ever given him the things that he needs. But what he wants is he wants peace. He wants to stop wanting. He wants to stop hurting from the absence of things.
Yeah.
He wants what we all want, really, which is... That still moment, what T.S. Eliot talks about, that still moment in the center of the universe where you're beyond wanting, where you just are. And he craves that. I think as Christians crave it, as religious people crave it, it's to beyond wanting and needing and being hurt by the absence of. He's like a shark. He never can stop swimming.
Because he isn't fulfilled.
There's no rest.
There's no rest. And here's what I think he uses as a metaphor: four spinning fan blades, wheels and voices, round and round. And after all, as he saw it now, there was to this network of malice no ending, none whatever.
Yeah.
So there's the fan.
Yeah, and there also, I think, is Truman's personal suspicion that he was going to end up like this guy, alone, disliked, and dissatisfied. Because you've got to remember, pursuing the things that Walter pursues is an exhausting activity, and that speaks to what you're talking about. It's exhausting to be constantly hungry and constantly searching and constantly wanting and scamming and trying this and trying that. I mean, he doesn't just want peace. He wants stillness. He wants to stop reaching for things and grabbing for things and losing things.
Yeah.
And I think that it really is Capote's worry, very real worry, that he was going to end up like this. Here he was 23 years old. He was desperate to be taken seriously as a young man, as a young writer. He was a young gay man. He was desperate to be accepted and to be liked. And, you know, he was a 5'2" homosexual coming from the deep south. That's got to be a haunting experience. And I think this is a story about Truman's self-loathing, that it's a projection of what if my life goes this way? What if I fail as a writer? What if I fail as a lovable person?
Right at the very end, he talks about the heat frightening him, for it made him know tangibly his own helplessness. So he's yearning for something, but he realizes that he can't attain it on his own. Is that it?
That he can't fix it. Whatever is wrong with his life, his unhappiness,
and that's despair, isn't it?
It's complete despair because there's no end to it.
Yeah. You think, and he can't do anything about it.
There's no solution to it.
Yeah.
It's a continuous sensation that it would appear to go on for the rest of your life. And I think one of the reasons that Truman had the drinking and substance abuse problems that he had, and I mean this, is that I think he did that to quiet those sensations, to anesthetize himself from the constant wanting and the constant sense of dissatisfaction. Yeah. And I think that that's why he drank. I think his pursuit of alcohol eventually became addiction. It was seeking an anesthetic.
Yeah.
If you're feeling that kind of stuff all the time, all you want is a little holiday from yourself.
Yeah.
And he can't do anything about it.
And he realizes that too.
But booze can. Booze can give you, booze and pills can give you a temporary island of respite from all of these sensations. The problem is that when you sober up or come down, the hangover comes on and the things are...
It's all there again.
It's all there again, and sometimes worse, because of the things that you do to make yourself feel better often result in things that make you feel worse. Well, aren't we smarty pants?
We think we are.
Well, that's all that matters.
We're having a good time, though. That's what matters.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an example of... It's not a terribly long read, but it's a lot of juice there, isn't it?
Oh, God, man. I think it's a wonderful story. I think it's just jam-packed with goodies.